tensions and chaos surrounding the freeze escalated at the end of July when Duffy, a political appointee at OMB, with no relevant experience in funding approvals, took authority for releasing military aid to Ukraine away from Sandy, a career OMB official. Sandy could think of no other explanation of a political, no other example of a political appointee taking on this responsibility. Sandy was given no reason other than that Mr. Duffy wanted to be, quote, more involved in daily operations, end quote. During his deposition, Sandy confirmed that he was removed from the funding approval process after he had raised concerns to Duffy about whether the hold was legal under the Impoundment Control Act. Needless to say, OMB has refused to turn over any documents or communications involving that decision to replace Mr. Sandy. Why did Duffy, a political appointee with no relevant experience in this area, take over responsibility for Ukraine funding approval? Was the White House involved in that decision?
Live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump on KPFB and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz. Currently, we are listening to Democratic Representative Jason Crow of Colorado. He is one of the seven floor managers for House Democrats. He is arguing in favor of an amendment that has been brought by Chuck Schumer that would require the subpoena of documents from the Office of Management and Budget.
A memo about Ukraine military aid to Acting Director Vought. According to Sandy, the memo advocated for the release of the funds. It said that the military aid was consistent with American national security interests, it would help to oppose Russian aggression, and it was backed by strong bipartisan support. But President Trump did not lift the hold. Over the next several weeks, OMB continued to issue funding documents that kept kicking the can down the road, supposedly to allow for more of this, quote, interagency process. Well, inserting those footnotes throughout the apportionment documents stating that the delay wouldn't affect the funding. But here's the really shocking part. There was no interagency process. They made it up. It had ended months before. They made it up because nobody could say the real reason for the hold. In total, OMB issued 9 of these documents between July 25th and September 10th. Did the White House respond to OMB's concerns and recommendation to release the aid? Did the White House instruct OMB to continue creating a paper trail in an effort to justify the hold? Who knew what and when? OMB documents would shed light on OMB's actions as the president's scheme unraveled. Did the White House direct OMB to continue issuing the hold? What was OMB told about the president's reasons for releasing the hold? What communications did OMB officials have with the White House around the time of the release? As the president's scheme unraveled, did anyone at OMB connect the dots about the real reason for the hold? The OMB documents would shed light on all of these questions, and the American people deserve answers. I remember what it feels like to not have the equipment you need when you need it. Real people's lives are at stake. That's why this matters. We need this information so we can ensure that this never happens again. Eventually, this will all come out. We will have answers to these questions. The question now is whether we'll have them in time and who here will be on the right side of history.
Mr. Sekulow?
Mr. Chief Justice, the House
Those are remarks from Representative Jason Crow, Democrat from Colorado, arguing in favor of an amendment by Chuck Schumer that would require the subpoena of documents from the Office of Management and Budget. This is the office that determines where funds go, and it was the office that withheld the military aid to Ukraine. We now get the rebuttal from Jay Sekulow, who is the personal attorney for Donald Trump.
Those were not provided by the previous administration. The suggestion that the Ukraine failed to get any equipment is false. The security assistant was not for funding Ukraine over the summer of 2019. There was no lack of equipment due to the temporary pause. It was future funding. The Ukraine Deputy Minister of Defense, who oversaw U.S. aid shipments, said the hold came and went so quickly they did not notice any change. Undersecretary of State David Hale explained the paused aid was future assistance, not to keep the Army going now. So the made-up narrative that security assistance was conditioned on Ukraine taking some action on investigations is further disproved by the straightforward fact that the aid was delivered on September 11, 2019, without Ukraine taking any action on any investigation. It's interesting to note that the Obama administration withheld $585 million of promised aid to Egypt in 2013. But the administration's public message was that the money was not officially on hold, as technically it was not due until September 30th, the end of the fiscal year. So they didn't have to disclose the halt to anyone. Sounds like this may be a practice of a number of administrations. In fact, to the president, this president has been concerned about how aid is being put forward. So there have been pauses on foreign aid in a variety of contexts. In September of 2019, the administration announced that it was withholding over $100 million in aid to Afghanistan over concerns about government corruption. In August of 2019, President Trump announced that the administration and Seoul were in talks to substantially increase South Korea's share of the expense of U.S. military support for South Korea. In June, President Trump paused over $550 million in foreign aid to El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala because those countries were not fairly sharing the burdens of preventing mass migration to the United States. This is not the only administration. As I said, President Obama withheld hundreds of millions of dollars of aid to Egypt. To be clear, and I want to be clear, Ambassador Yovanovitch herself testified that our policy actually got stronger under President Trump, largely because, unlike the Obama administration, quote, this administration made the decision to provide lethal weapons to Ukraine to help Ukraine fend off Russian aggression. She testified in a deposition before your various committees that, and actually I felt that in the 3 years that I was there, partly because of my efforts, but also the interagency team and President Trump's decision to provide lethal weapons to Ukraine, that our policy actually got stronger. Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent, names come up a couple of times, agree that javelins are incredibly effective weapons at stopping armored advance, and the Russians are scared of them. Ambassador Volker explained that President Trump approved each of the decisions made along the way, and as a result, America's policy towards Ukraine strengthened. So when we want to talk about facts, go to your own discovery and your own witnesses that you called. This all supposedly started because of a whistleblower. Where is that whistleblower? Hey, you'll lose the mic.
The House managers have 35 minutes remaining.
Mr. Chief Justice, at war,
we now return
matters.
To Democratic Representative Jason Crow.
Minutes and hours can seem like years. So the idea that, well, it made it there eventually just doesn't work. And yes, the aid was provided. It was provided by Congress. This Senate in the House of Representatives with the president's signature. The Congress is the one that sends the aid. And millions of dollars of this aid would have been lost because of the delay had Congress not actually passed another law that extended that deadline to allow the funds to be spent. Let me repeat that. The delay had jeopardized the expenditure of the money to such an extent that Congress had to pass another law to extend the deadline so that the money and the equipment got to the people on the front lines. Need I also reiterate this supposed interagency process? You know, the concerns that the president and his counsel continue to raise about corruption and making sure that the process went right. There was no interagency process. The whole thing was made up. It was a phantom. There was a delay, and delays matter. Mr. Chief Justice, I reserve the balance of my time for Mr. Schiff.
Mr. Schiff?
We now turn back to Representative Adam Schiff, who's the lead impeachment manager. Again, this is a debate for an amendment to the rules brought by Senator, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer, to require issuing subpoenas for the Office of Management and Budget pertaining to the issue of withholding aid to Ukraine.
Right? Yes, they got the money after the president got caught, after the president was forced to relieve the hold on the aid, after he got caught, yes. But even then they had held on to the aid so long that it took a subsequent act of Congress to make sure it could all go out the door. So what, is the president supposed to get credit for that, that we had to intervene because he withheld the aid so long? And that's the only reason Ukraine got all of the aid that we had approved in the first place? My colleagues have glossed over the fact that what they did was illegal, that the GAO, an independent watchdog agency, found that that hold was illegal. So it not only violated the law, it not only took an act of Congress to make sure they ultimately got the aid. This is supposed to be the defense to why you shouldn't see the documents? Is that what we're to believe? Now, counsel also says, well, you know, he's not the first president to withhold aid. And that's true. After all, counsel says, well, President Obama withheld aid to Egypt. Yes, at the urging of members of Congress. Senators McCain and Graham urged that aid be withheld. And why? Because there was a revolution in Egypt after it was appropriated. That wasn't something that was hidden from Congress. That was a pretty darn good reason to think, do we still want to give aid to this government after this revolution? We're not saying that aid has never been withheld. That's absurd. But I would hope and expect this is the first time aid has been withheld by a president of the United States to coerce an ally at war to help him cheat in the next election. I think that's a first. But what we do here may determine whether it's the last. And one other thing about this pause in aid, right? The argument, well, no harm, no foul. Okay, you got caught, they got the aid. What's the big deal? Well, as we heard during the trial, it's not just the aid. I mean, the aid is obviously the most important thing. As Mr. Crow mentioned, you know, without it, you can't defend yourself, and we'll have testimony about just what kind of military aid the president was withholding. But we also had testimony that it was the fact of the aid itself that was so important to Ukraine, the fact that the United States had Ukraine's back. And why? Because this new president of Ukraine, this new untested former comedian, president of Ukraine, at war with Russia, was going to be going into a negotiation with Vladimir Putin with an eye to ending that conflict. And whether he went into that negotiation from a position of strength or a position of weakness would depend on whether we had his back. And so when the Ukrainians learned and the Russians learned that the President of the United States did not have his back, was withholding this aid, what message do you think that sent to Vladimir Putin? What message do you think it sent to Vladimir Putin when Donald Trump wouldn't let Vladimir Zelensky, our ally, in the door at the White House, but would let the Russian foreign minister? What message does that send? So it's not just the aid, it's not just when the aid is delivered, it's not just if all of the aid is delivered, it's also what message does the freeze send to our friend, and even more importantly, to our foe? And the message it sent was a disaster. Was a disaster. Now, you might ask yourself, because counsel has said, hey, President Trump has given lethal weapons to Ukraine. You might ask yourself, if the president was so concerned about corruption, why did he do that in 2017? And why did he do that in 2018? Why was it only 2019 that there was a problem? Was there no corruption in Ukraine in 2017? Was there no corruption in Ukraine in 2018? No. Ukraine has always battled corruption. It wasn't the presence or lack of corruption in one year to another. It was the presence of Joe Biden as a potential candidate for president. That was the key change in 2019. That made all the difference. Which gets back to one of the key moments in this saga. You know, a lot of you are attorneys. You're probably much better attorneys than I am. And I'm sure you had the experience in cases you tried where there was some vignette, some conversation, some document. It may not have been the most important on its face, but it told you something about the case that was much larger than that conversation. For me, one of those conversations was not on July 25th between President Trump and President Zelensky, but on July 26th, the very next day. Now, you may have watched some of the House proceedings, or you may haven't, and people watching may have seen it, maybe they didn't. But there's this scene in a Ukrainian restaurant, a restaurant in Kyiv, with Gordon Sondland. Now, bear in mind, Gordon Sondland, who said there was absolutely a quid pro quo, and 2 + 2 = 4, this is not some never-Trumper. This is a million-dollar donor to the Trump inauguration, okay? If there's a bias there, it's clearly a million-dollar bias in favor of this president, not against him. So there's a scene in Kyiv, in this restaurant, and Sondland has a cell phone, and he's sitting with David Holmes, who is a career diplomat, U.S. diplomat in the Ukraine embassy. And Gordon Sondland takes out his phone, and he calls the White House. Gordon Sondland holding for the White House. Gordon Sondland holding for the president. And it takes a while to be connected, but he's connected to the president. That's pretty impressive, right? This isn't some guy with no relationship to the president. The president may say, Gordon Sondland, I barely know him, or something to that effect, but this is a guy who can pick up a cell phone. He can call the president of the United States from a restaurant in Kyiv, and he does. And the president's voice is so loud that David Holmes, this diplomat, can hear it. And what does the president say? Does he say, how's that reform coming in the Rada? How's the attack on corruption going? No. He just says, is he going to do the investigation? Is Zelensky going to do the investigation? And Sondland says, yes. He'll do anything you want. He loves your ass. This is the extent of the president's interest in Ukraine. And they go on to talk about other things, and then they hang up. And David Holmes turns to the ambassador and says, in language which I will have to modify, to remove an expletive, says something along the lines of, does the president give a blank about Ukraine? And Sondland says, no, he doesn't give a blank about Ukraine. He only cares about the big stuff, like the investigation of the Bidens that Giuliani wants. This is a $1 million donor to the Trump inaugural, admitting the president doesn't care about Ukraine. He doesn't care whether they get military dollars to defend themselves. He doesn't care about what position Zelensky goes into in these negotiations with Putin. He doesn't care about that. Isn't that clear? It's why he didn't care about corruption in 2017 or 2018, and he certainly didn't care about it in 2019. All he cared about was the big stuff that affected him personally, like this investigation that he wanted of the Bidens. So when you ask, do you want to see these documents? Do you want to know if these documents corroborate Ambassador Sondland? Will the documents show, as we fully expect they will, that the only thing he cared about was the big stuff that affected him? David Holmes' response was, well, you know, there's some big stuff going on here, like a war with Russia. This isn't withholding aid because of a revolution in Egypt. This is withholding aid from a country in which 15,000 people have died fighting the Russians. And as Ambassador Taylor said, and others, you know, Russia's fighting to remake the map of Europe by dint of military force. If we think that's just about Ukraine's security, we are very deceived. It's about our security. It's about the tens of thousands of troops that we have in Europe. And if we undercut our own ally, if we give Russia reason to believe we will not have their back, that we'll use Ukraine as a plaything, or worse, to get them to help us cheat in an election, that will only embolden Putin to do more. You've said it as often as I have. The only thing he respects is strength. You think that looks like strength to Vladimir Putin? I think that looks like something that Vladimir Putin is only too accustomed to. And that is the kind of corruption that he finds and he perpetuates in his own regime and he pushes all around the world. My colleague Val Demings made reference to a conversation which I think is one of the other key vignettes in this whole sad saga. And that's that conversation that Ambassador Volker has with Andrei Yermak, one of the top aides to President Zelensky. And this is a conversation in which Ambassador Bolton Ambassador Volker is doing exactly what he's supposed to be doing, which is he's telling Yermak, you know, you guys shouldn't really do this investigation of your former President Poroshenko, because it would be for a political reason. You really shouldn't engage in political investigations. And as Representative Deming said, what's the response from Ukrainians? Oh, you mean like the one you want us to do of the Bidens and the Clintons? Threw it right back in his face. Ukraine's not oblivious to that hypocrisy. Mr. Sekulow says, what are we here for? You know, part of our strength is not only our support for our allies, it's not only our military might, it's what we stand for. We used to stand for the rule of law. We used to champion the rule of law around the world. Part of the rule of law is, of course, that no one is above the law. But to be out in Ukraine or anywhere else in the world championing the rule of law and saying, don't engage in political prosecutions, and having them throw it right back in our face, oh, you mean like the one you want us to do? That's why we're here. That's why we're here. That's why we're here. I yield back.
Representative Adam Schiff.
Mr. Justice.
The majority leader is recognized.
I send Mitch a motion McConnell. To the desk to table the amendment and ask for the yeas and nays.
Is there a sufficient second? There is. The clerk will conduct, will call the roll.
Mr. Alexander.
Aye.
Ms. Baldwin.
No.
Mr. Barrasso.
Aye.
Mr. Bennett.
No.
Mrs. Blackburn.
Aye.
Mr. Blumenthal.
No.
Mr. Blunt.
Aye.
Mr. Booker.
Senate is now voting on whether to table an amendment from Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York that would require the Senate to subpoena the Office of Management and Budget concerning documents between the Office of Management and Budget and probably the Pentagon. And this all pertains to the withholding of military funds to and military aid to Ukraine. Every amendment that Chuck Schumer has brought, this is his third now, has been tabled, meaning effectively killed, by a 53-47 vote. That corresponds exactly with 53 Republicans in the Senate and 47 Democrats, which all of these amendments so far have been by the party line. Once this vote is over, we anticipate the Senate to take a 30-minute break, and then throughout the evening, it'll probably come back, hear at least one more, and debate one more amendment from Chuck Schumer trying to change the rules as they are now, as they are now from Mitch McConnell, until they finally get to a final vote a little bit later on the rules themselves. A programming update for you. We are going to wrap up our coverage at 5 p.m. And then at 5 p.m., we're going to have Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 6 p.m., we will have the KPFA Evening News. And throughout both of those programs, you'll probably get updates of where we are in the final vote for the impeachment rules. Now, there was some movement on these rules today. They are not as they looked earlier this morning or as of last night, in which many Democrats decried the rules because Mitch McConnell was going to force both the floor managers from the House of Representatives and Trump's defense team to use 24 hours in oral arguments over 2 days each. So each side would have gets 24 hours to make their arguments, and they would only have 2 days each to use those 24 hours, which would mean 12-hour oral 12-hour days of oral arguments. He has relented from that position, and he has added an additional day for each team. So each team will now get 3 days to present 24 hours worth of oral arguments, which if you do the math, you do the division, it would mean 8 hours per day. So on the East Coast, the trial is starting every day at 1 p.m. And so for them on the East Coast, it would go until about probably about 9 or 10, maybe even 11, considering breaks. For us here, that would probably mean around 6, 7, or 8 o'clock when oral arguments begin in earnest. And speaking of oral arguments beginning in earnest, that's what we will have tomorrow. Today has solely been about what are the rules going to be in the Senate trial. The other significant change that Mitch McConnell has made to his rules is allowing the evidence from the House impeachment inquiry to be used and to be a part of the official Senate record on the trial. Originally, in his proposal from last night and early morning, Mitch McConnell was not going to allow that evidence to be officially registered in the Senate until the Senate would vote for it, and the Senate wouldn't vote on that until after the oral arguments and after senators get 16 hours to ask their questions to both the House managers and the defense team that's representing President Donald Trump. So that has changed. He is going to allow that evidence to come in. The evidence, though, and these motions that are being tabled, in other words, basically turned down by the Senate, is to get documents that were kept from the House impeachment inquiry. Keep in mind, and this is really getting to the heart of Article 2 of the impeachment articles, meaning obstruction of Congress. The White House just basically did a blanket obstruction, not allowing any documents to be handed over to Congress in its inquiry to the House of Representatives, nor did it allow any of their people to testify. Now, people testified, some people testified anyways, but the White House tried to stop everyone they could from testifying. So right now, particularly what they're voting on is an amendment from Chuck Schumer that would allow for the subpoena, to issue a subpoena to the Office of Management and Budget to get their documents to learn more about the withholding of the military aid to Ukraine. Not likely to pass. So again, today, the entire hearing today is based on the rules. Tomorrow, once they approve the rules, a little bit later tonight, once they approve the rules, then tomorrow they will start the oral arguments in earnest, in which we'll have a day of arguments from the House. The vote is done. And any moment now, we will hear John Roberts announce the tally.
The yeas are 53. The nays are 47. The motion is tabled.
So that motion will not move forward after this.
The Democratic leader is recognized.
This is Chuck Schumer.
Mr. Chief Justice, I send an amendment to the desk to issue a subpoena to John Michael Mick Mulvaney. And I ask that it be read.
Clerk will report.
We are now looking at another amendment by Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Senator from New York, Mr. Schumer, proposes an amendment number 1287.
Mick Mulvaney. This is the Senate clerk reading the language of the amendment.
Following. Section, notwithstanding any other provision of this resolution pursuant to Rules 5 and 6 of the Rules of Procedure and Practice in the Senate when sitting on impeachment trials, the Chief Justice of the United States, through the Secretary of the Senate, shall issue a subpoena for the taking of testimony of John Michael Mick Mulvaney, and the Sergeant-at-Arms is authorized to utilize the services of the Deputy Sergeant-at-Arms or any other employee of the Senate in serving the subpoena authorized to be issued by this section.
Mr. Chief Justice.
The Majority Leader is recognized.
Mitch McConnell.
And I ask for a 30-minute recess before the parties are recognized to debate the Schumer Amendment. Following the debate time, I will once again move to table the amendment because votes on witnesses and evidence, as I've repeatedly said, are addressed in the underlying resolution. So I ask that the Senate stand in recess until 8 p.m.
Without objection, so ordered.
So the Senate is taking a half-hour break. When it returns from its break, it will have further debates about the amendment to have the Senate subpoena Mick Mulvaney, who is the acting chief of staff to President Donald Trump, one of the most important positions, non-elected positions, non-confirmable. You don't need Senate confirmation for chief of staff positions in government, probably the closest person, along with the national security advisor, to a president. We know Mick Mulvaney has been instrumental also with his role at the Office of Management and Budget, where he was also heading that agency and has been vital concerning the withholding of the military aid to Ukraine. So that should be an interesting debate when it comes up. Not likely it's going to, and again, it gets a little tricky here, the motion will be tabled, meaning that it'll just kind of be put under the table and won't be considered anymore after this. And every amendment that Chuck Schumer has brought so far has been tabled. In a moment, we're going to get to guests for analysis. But first, friends, our broadcast of the Senate impeachment trial is possible only through the financial support of you and of other listeners. Now, KPFA is dedicating itself, including the resources necessary to do this, to ensure that we can bring you this historic, only third time in U.S. history, Senate impeachment trial of a sitting U.S. president. If you appreciate hearing this broadcast on KPFA, a trusted source that you can go to. If we have been able to explain the process to you, if we have been able to provide a historical analysis and guests that you trust, I'm going to ask you to donate whatever you can to KPFA right now because, well, again, we are using additional resources that we hadn't budgeted for in order to do these broadcasts. And so whatever money we can raise during these broadcasts would go towards what we, you know, the resources we need to be able to pull this broadcast off, which could last potentially up to a month. We're not taking phone calls for those donations. We're just asking you to go online at kpfa.org. There you can, you know, look at the thank you gifts we have. We have all kinds of swag. We have the great KPFA hoodie, the fine water, reusable water bottle, tote bag. We got socks. We got all kinds of things we could look at. But what we really need is your support in order to do broadcasts like these. So just go to kpfa.org. And last time I put this out there, a couple of people called in wanting the address to mail in a check, I guess. So, hey, let me just give you the address, too, so you don't have to call in and do that. It's just to KPFA, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, Berkeley, California, 94707. Again, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, Berkeley, California, 94707. And the best way you could support us right now is by pledging online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich. We're going to stay with you up until the top of the hour where we'll hand it off to Dennis Bernstein and Flashpoints. And we're going to have analysis for the next 23 minutes or so. And joining me on the telephone for reaction is Alan Hirsch. Alan Hirsch is a lecturer in humanities, chair of justice and law studies at Williams College, and author of the book Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future. Alan Hirsch, it is my good pleasure to welcome you back to this radio station.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you have dived into the two previous Senate impeachment trials that we have had in this history, Andrew Johnson in 1868 and then Bill Clinton in 1999. After observing and seeing what has happened in this, really the first day, officially the first day was last week of swearing in and everything, but now today debating and eventually voting on the rules of the Senate, what are you thinking about? What stands out to you?
To me, this is Alice in Wonderland, verdict first, trial later. And the verdict is not guilty. Virtually all of the Republicans have made it clear that that's the outcome they want. And right now, they're just trying to finesse the process so that politically this is as palatable as possible.
Now,
I think. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say Mitch McConnell has relented a little bit on his original proposal that he unveiled last week. Again, instead of having just 2 days for each side to present 24 hours worth of oral arguments, it's now 3 days, which means it would be 8 hours per day. And then also allowing, he has changed and relented on the issue about evidence, not new evidence, but evidence that was acquired during the House impeachment inquiry to also be a part of the record.
Right. So not to be too cynical, but I can't help but thinking that he asked for he proposed the ridiculous 2 days, which would have had the hearings go on past midnight, only so that he could propose the 3 days at 8 hours and claim it was a compromise.
Yeah.
When it's obviously still rushing this through. As for the evidence, as you point out, this is evidence everyone already knows about. So whether it's technically in the record is just that, a technicality. Obviously, what's at stake is will there be any truth-finding, truth-seeking, which would require new evidence. It would require testing the proposition that the president did nothing wrong and so forth, and there are witnesses prepared to testify to shed light on that. In the Andrew Johnson trial, there were 40-some-odd witnesses. In the Clinton case, there were only three who were deposed. That was by agreement between the parties because neither side particularly wanted live witnesses. There's really no precedent for one side basically shutting down the inquiry before it begins.
What about the argument that the House should have tried harder to get these witnesses, to get these documents, that what the Senate should be doing is just considering the articles of impeachment based on what the House had at that time when it voted for impeachment?
It really doesn't make any sense. I mean, there's no rule. By analogy to the criminal justice system, what the House did was an indictment. There's no rule that once a prosecutor has indicted a defendant, they can't look for new evidence. that the only evidence allowed at trial is evidence that was presented to the grand jury or that was available to them when they drafted the indictment. That just, there's no precedent for that argument. Is it true that the House could have sought to put on more testimony? Sure. And there was no obligation for them to do so. They found that the requisite standard was met for impeaching the president, and there's no reason at all that new evidence shouldn't be sought now. Had the House sought that evidence, had they subpoenaed John Bolton and others, they would have been tied up in a court fight for several months, and they made the pragmatic decision that that wasn't wise. That may have been a mistake, but if so, it was a political mistake. It wasn't the equivalent of what the House is doing now. Oh, I'm sorry, what the Senate is doing now, which is simply shutting down a process for their own advantage.
If they did go to the courts, and again, this is a moot point because the House is done with its work, but that I've heard that often, that it would just tie up the process in time because it could take months. Is it not possible the courts could have expedited such a process because of the importance and timeliness of it?
It's conceivable. And as I said, it may be that the House made a miscalculation. You know, that's outside my area of expertise, yeah. Just sort of the pragmatic workings of the House. And no one could have predicted how long the court process would have taken. Personally, I would have advised them to subpoena key witnesses and then to seek an expedited decision-making in the courts. I think that would have been wise. I think they made a mistake. But that was simply a mistake in calculation, in tactics. It wasn't shirking their duty, which, in my opinion, is what the Senate is doing now.
Let me ask you about a criminal court case. And this isn't what that is, but since that's oftentimes being used as an analogy, Is it common after the grand jury does its work and the person has been indicted and it's now to the trial to submit new information that the grand jury did not submit itself?
Oh, absolutely. You're under no obligation to be limited to what the grand jury saw. You have to understand there's a different standard. Before the grand jury, you only have to establish probable cause that a crime was committed, and then you have to prove the person guilty beyond reasonable doubt at trial. So it's not at all uncommon for the grand jury to be presented with minimal evidence, and then at trial you bring out all your evidence. And so there's nothing to that claim that the House was obligated to do all the legwork first before it got to the Senate.
Do you think that Adam Schiff is right and that not only – and he said this much earlier in the day, many, many hours ago, that this isn't just a trial against Donald Trump, but this is actually also going to be a trial – I don't know if you use the word trial, but that's what the word I'm using, of the Senate and how the Senate performs, how Congress performs through this process.
Yes, I think that's accurate. I think that history will make that judgment to some extent, but voters will get a chance to make that judgment in November. And I think that Democrats, obviously very frustrated that they're not getting what they consider a fair shake, a legitimate truth-seeking trial. But what they will get is the opportunity to litigate that in the court of public opinion. And I think that's all that's left. But in a democracy, that's also ultimately what's most important.
Do you not think that when they get to the point of voting on witnesses, and to be clear, according to the rules, it's not just we vote for witnesses and now we have them. They would be deposed first behind closed doors, and after that process, then they would decide who would actually give public testimony and who would not. Do you not have any hope in what may happen in potentially having witnesses? It appears there could be four or five Republicans that have expressed wanting to hear witnesses.
I have a little hope, and it's based largely on the public opinion polls, which show anywhere from high 50s to low 70s support for there being witnesses. And one would like to think that Susan Collins and three other Republicans who are nervous about their reelection prospects, or Mitt Romney, who doesn't have to worry about reelection, you would hope that four or five or six of them will be profiles in courage. But nothing that's happened today or really in recent history gives me cause for a lot of hope.
What do you think this does to impeachment? And again, I shouldn't say this again, but we've talked many times over the past few months. You've indicated that impeachment in many times in which it has happened, maybe the two Senate trials, at least that we've had for Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, were not appropriate uses of impeachment. Is this just another in a string of how impeachment has been used so far?
Well, the difference is, in the case of Clinton and Johnson, I believe that the presidents did not commit impeachable offenses. So the misuse of the process was by those who sought to use impeachment too easily, too promiscuously. And I think here that's not the case. I think the Democrats were justified in impeaching this president. And I think the misuse of the process is by the Senate in not conducting a fair trial. But will this tarnish impeachment as a constitutional tool in the future? That's number one, that's a great question. Number two, I don't know. And number three, if so, that will be a tragedy for this country, because it really is a very important constitutional provision.
Why?
And if it is viewed solely as a political football, then it is diminished, if not eliminated, as a legitimate weapon, and we need it.
Talk to me about the importance of impeachment. Now, I understand the gravity of impeachment, because you're talking about removing a president who, at the very least, had won an electoral college to win the election. But constitutionally speaking, how does impeachment fit in with the overall Constitution?
Remember that we were rebelling against England because they had a king who was too powerful and oppressive, potentially. Now, one safeguard against that was having a president who had to be elected. And it wasn't a hereditary position, and he was term limited to a maximum of 8 years. That is very important, but it's not sufficient. Because what happens with a president who, for example, rigs an election or who achieves just ridiculous power for that 4 or 8 year period? The only remedy then is impeachment. Without it, we are at the mercy of a lawless president, and especially when his party is in the majority, you see what happens. But the paradox of impeachment is it can only succeed when it's got bipartisan support. So when you have a lawless president aligned with a supportive party, you get the position that we are in right now. And that's why we're all nervously awaiting to see if there are 4 or 5 Republicans. But think how pathetic this is. All we are hoping for is witnesses. Then do we have any confidence that there would be 15, or I guess it has to be 20 Republicans, who would be even open to the idea of convicting a president of their own party? And there's absolutely no reason to be optimistic about that.
In thinking about the two articles of impeachment, the first article is abuse of power, and that is about Donald Trump using his office for personal gain. That's the allegation. The second article of impeachment, to me, is the one I'm most interested in, and that is obstruction of Congress. And it's like obstruction of justice, but it's obstructing Congress. It is the White House's blanketed refusal to comply with any subpoenas or even allow any of its people, government officials we're talking about when we say its people, to come testify to Congress. Now, some people did testify anyways, but the people that you really need, like what they're debating now concerning this amendment to try to issue a subpoena to Mick Mulvaney, none of those individuals would come and testify. I mean, if this is successful, and it's really a political question as it will if it'll be successful or not, depending on what happens in the Senate. To me, it has always seemed we're looking at a very dangerous precedent upon previous precedents. This isn't a new dynamic of presidents always using perhaps overusing executive privilege. But this to me, just to do we've never seen a blanketed obstruction the way we are concerning this case.
Well, I agree that it's unprecedented, and I agree that it's concerning. But to be honest, I'm more focused on the abuse of power than the obstruction of Congress, because there is the courts as a remedy for the latter. They could have basically taken Trump to court on that. They could have subpoenaed witnesses and gotten rulings. And then had he defied those, I think you would have an airtight case for obstruction. So I'm more concerned about the fact that he defied the will of Congress and he sought political dirt against a political opponent and sacrificed the nation's national security and foreign policy to that. That, to me, is the more severe charge.
And finally, what will you be looking for here moving forward? And, you know, conceivably, if it's up to Mitch McConnell, this may be all over by the end of next week. I have a hard time seeing that happen, but you never know. But perhaps over the next 2 to 4 weeks, what are you going to be looking for? What's important to you?
I think the main thing is the vote on whether to have witnesses. I think that's really where the action is. Because if that is shut down, this is game, set, match. If witnesses are allowed, then we are allowed the ray of hope. It will mean that several Republicans at least were forced to recognize the possibility that the case against the president could be serious enough to warrant his removal. And if there's at least that degree of open-mindedness, number one, that's a good thing in itself, and number two, the public will get to see the evidence. You know, maybe at the end of the day, everyone's assuming they know what John Bolton's going to say. We don't have the foggiest idea.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll come forward and surprise us and say, look, I didn't support the holdup of the aid, but I think the president really was concerned about obstruction or something else. But that's what we need to find out. And it seems to me right now there is such an asymmetry. It's often this shouting match between the parties, and you don't know who's in the right. But here it seems like one side is simply asking for access to the truth-seeking process, and the other is trying essentially to abet a president's cover-up.
You mentioned earlier that Andrew Johnson, I think it was something like 40 witnesses, testified in his. Now, Andrew Johnson, I don't know if they're all in the Senate trial, but that trial went 10 weeks. Bill Clinton's trial went 5 weeks. There were witnesses, but only three, and none of them came in person to testify. It was all on videotape and depositions. Why did that happen with Bill Clinton's trial?
So the context for Clinton's trial is in between the impeachment and the trial was an election. And the Democrats did surprisingly well, and the Republicans were left with little stomach for this whole process. So it was by joint agreement. That's the biggest difference between what we're seeing now and what happened in the Clinton trial. There was agreement between the leadership representing their respective caucuses that this was the compromise that was reached. They would depose the three witnesses. They would then make a determination of whether they would be brought before the Senate for a full examination and cross-examination, and then each side chose instead to use whatever snippets they wanted of videotape of the depositions, as you say. So the big difference, I mean, that was a limited trial, to be sure, but that was by agreement of the parties. They both thought it was in their interest to have essentially this limited trial. And if we got even that, I think a lot of people right now would take it. Deposing the witnesses and let the parties show what they want from it. The Clinton compromise imported to this case, I think we'd consider an acceptable outcome. But as of now, I'm not sure we're even going to get that.
Forgive me. I know I said last question 2 questions ago.
Okay.
I think this will be my last question. And that is about John Bolton, somebody you brought up earlier, who served as the National Security Advisor for a short time to President Donald Trump. Trump has indicated, at least the White House has indicated or strongly suggested, that if he was subpoenaed to come testify to the Senate trial, he would invoke executive privilege. That would obviously have to be, I guess, worked out by the courts. This would be unprecedented in a presidential impeachment, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would, and it would not unfold the way the president is suggesting, because John Bolton has indicated that he's happy to appear before the Senate. His lawyers have suggested he would not be invoking executive privilege, which, in fact, I don't think he could invoke anyway. I think it would have to be invoked for him. But I think the president's argument with respect to this is frivolous.
Really? Because isn't the claim that executive privilege, legally speaking, is at its strongest point when it concerns national security? And I mean, he being the national security advisor.
That's accurate. But as far it all depends what Bolton plans to say, which at this point we don't know. I don't think he has any interest in divulging classified information, for example. I think more or less he would confirm that what we know happened and that he was opposed to it. That's the expectation. But we don't know. And if he were deposed, there would be a reasonable period for the Senate leadership to claim that what he has to say would be too inflammatory, too dangerous to the national security for the country to hear. And then it could go to court if need be. Maybe the Democrats would agree with that. But right now, it's all speculation. Remember, the president didn't want anyone to testify. Some people testified anyway, and was America's national security threatened?
Yeah. And then there's talk that if he were to testify, it would be behind closed doors, not open to the public.
Initially.
Yeah.
You know, we'll see. I don't know. You know, this is speculation cubed at this point, because my real fear is that the Senate's going to give a thumbs down to even his being deposed.
Alan Hirsch has been our guest. He's a lecturer in humanities, chair of justice and law studies at Williams College, and author of the book Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future. Alan Hirsch, I thank you for taking time for us today.
Thank you.
Friends, as we move to wrap up here, again, just a reminder that KPFA is dedicating itself to covering the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. And that, of course, means resources that we hadn't had budgeted for to be able to make that happen. The way broadcasts like this occur is through the support of listeners like you. And I want to encourage you, if you appreciate the broadcast, if you appreciate the historical analysis that we provide, the legal analysis that we provide, and the actual hearings themselves, to donate what you can by going online. Now, we don't have a phone number for you to call, but we're just asking you to go online to kpfa.org. It's very easy. It's quick. It's secure. You'll be in and out within 2 minutes. If you could pledge $25, $50, $100, whatever is reasonable for you, it's what will allow us to continue to be able to do broadcasts like this one. And that does it for today's broadcast. Today's coverage was produced by Deanna Martinez. At the controls is Kyle Gustafson. Our interns are Jean Froge and Tanea Landry. Special thank you to the Operations and Engineering Department, Antonio Ortiz and I.A. Tullum, and to the News Department's Eileen Alfandari. Again, broadcasts like these are only possible because of your financial support for KPFA. Go online at kpfa.org. From our studios in Berkeley, I'm Mitch Jezerich, urging you to stay tuned for Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein.
Published a new book, Understanding Socialism. It destroys false narratives, confronts historic failures, reveals the way to a fresh socialism based on workplace democracy. Cornel West says Wolf's new book is the most accessible, reliable treatment we have of what socialism is, was, should be. Laura Sanders says it explains socialism in a way that's not only smart, but makes the rest of us feel smart. Chris Hedges says Wolf provides a sane and just socialist alternative to capitalist exploitation. Richard Wolf will discuss this new book Friday evening, February 28th at First Church, Berkeley, 2407 Dana Street. There's wheelchair access. Sabrina Jacobs will host this benefit for KPFA and Democracy at Work. Tickets at brownpapertickets.com or supportive bookstores.
KPFA, KPFB, Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org.
Stay tuned now.